好多才老爷呢，办点点考试上，我就是去年吧。
Chanda Kirti in his Madhyamika Avatara or engaging into the medium way says that at this point when you have the freedom and have the favorable conditions, at that time if you don't take care of yourself, then later on when you start falling into negative state of existence,then how could you help yourself at that time? Today we have access to Dharma and have obtained this precious human life, but because of being influenced by self-grasping and laziness, procrastination, we while away our life in this way. So if you imagine yourself,particularly in the case of someone who is now say in his 80s or 90s, then if you reflect carefully, and see what kind of spiritual practice that you have undertaken, where you can confidently say that even if now death occurs, I can pass away safely and peacefully. When you reflect in this way, then it's difficult to find practice that you have committed by which you can feel confident. So if we pass away or die without convincing kind of practice, then it is quite sad. So therefore at this point, even if you are physically aged and old, physically you are not very healthy and your eyes are not good, your brain is functioning, your mind is still, you can reflect on the qualities of the three objects of refuge, Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and also develop trust towards the cause-effect relationship, and particularly you can reflect on the great benefits of bodhicitta. And in this way, if you make a concerted effort, then it is possible to collect vast merits, and therefore it is important to appreciate the fact that you have today all the favorable external and internal factors at your disposal. As you said by the great Hong Tang Bua Master, that when you have all these facilities, external and internal facilities, and having met the spiritual plans, teachers, therefore do not procrastinate, do not remain lazy. So therefore you should engage in such a practice so that at the time of the death you will have no regret. So today we are kind of on a crossroad, whether you go up or down. Well, if you have no personal interest in religion, then of course it is altogether a different matter. And also if you follow a different religious tradition, then it's also a different matter. But if you're someone who follows the Buddhist teaching and follows the existence of the past and the future lives, then in that case it is extremely important to undertake a practice which definitely will help for the future lives. And since death is indefinite, it is important that every day you should engage in a practice which is beneficial. And it is said that some of the masters, when they go to sleep, then they would turn their cup or bowls upside down to indicate that it's not certain whether they will be able to get up the next morning or not. And they make a decisive conclusion with the confidence, thinking that even if I die tonight, there's nothing that I have to regret. And the next morning when they get up, then again they wake up with strong sense of appreciation, thinking that this is all due to the blessing and kindness of the Buddha, and therefore I will ensure that I do not waste my day. So therefore every day it is important to do some calculation as you do with your money, so that you are able to instill some confidence of having not to regret at the time of the death. And of course there are many different ways of undertaking religious practice, but the most important and the most effective ways of doing the Dharma practice is to use your own mind, which means meditating on loving kindness, compassion and bodhicitta, and there is no other spiritual practice which is more powerful and more effective than these practices. As Shantideva says in his Bodhicharya Avatara, that this practice of bodhicitta is really like the butter that you get after churning the milk. So likewise, this practice and teaching of the bodhicitta is the heart essence of all the teachings of the Buddha, and therefore it is important to undertake such a practice in your day-to-day life. And in order to meditate on bodhicitta, you should know the process. And therefore, today we are studying the Bodhicharya Avatara, which is complete and unmistaken. And most of the major words and teachings of the Buddha and the commentaries, there is hardly any text which doesn't speak and emphasize on the importance of development of bodhicitta. So all the teachings of the Buddha directly and indirectly fall on the essence of development of bodhicitta. And this is so because the purpose of all the teachings of the Buddha is to help sentient beings to achieve enlightenment. And the sole method, the only method to achieve such a state of omniscience is the development of bodhicitta. And it is because of this most of the sutras and tantras and their commentaries discuss and explain about the process of development of bodhicitta. And particularly in the case of a beginner, in the case of an ordinary practitioners like us, texts like this one, the Bodhicharya Avatara, is extremely effective and relevant. And as I explained yesterday, that the verse which reads that may the Buddhas visit the world, and may its teaching shine forth like the light of the sun, and may all his followers live harmoniously like brothers and sisters, and may the teaching flourish for a long time. So I found that this verse is from Ngoc Lo Sawa Lodin Shirap. He was a translator, Ngoc Lo Sawa Lodin Shirap. And there was another verse whose source His Holiness was asking and consulting a Lama sitting near him, saying that, "I think you explained to me the source of it." Then the Lama couldn't explain it. Then His Holiness jokingly told him that, "Are you saying that what is yesterday was yesterday and what is today is a different thing?" Then there is a verse called Gyalchen Chemo Wangi Gyalvune, that is by Lothar Rinpoche Sangpo. So we are reading the fifth chapter of the Bodhicharya Avatara, and we are now reading verse 19. If you are
Matam was a That's simple.
So this verse reads that if you are living amongst pronounced and distracted, uncontrolled crowd, and in other words, this means if you are living among a group of people or a crowd who are very boisterous and who are uncontrolled and very careless, so if you are living among them, and particularly if you are someone who has wounds on his body, then one has to be very attentive and very careful. For example, if all this group of people around you are stretching their legs and moving their hands all around and jumping all around, and then you have to be very careful to make sure that your wound is not disturbed. Similarly, if you are living amongst destructive and negative groups of people, then it's important to always guard the wound of your mind. And particularly these days, when we are confronted by a host of disturbing external and internal factors, and when the internal afflictive emotions are ready to burst out, ready to explode, so at that time it is extremely important to guard and watch your mind. The wound of the mind means that what we need is the beneficial and altruistic attitude and all the practices that are motivated by altruism. And so all those factors that would disturb and destroy the practices motivated by altruism is, these are the wound of your mind. Now, even with a minor sufferings of your wound on the body, you get frightened and you remain very careful. Now, if this is the case, what need is there to talk about guarding one's guarding the wound of the mind and to be fearful of the sufferings of the crashing hell? And if you live with such a way of life and conduct, then whether you abide amongst bad people or you live among women, then your conduct and discipline will not be disturbed, will not degenerate. So as I said earlier, this verse, this teaching is instructed to ordinary sanghas. So if you live among a crowd of women, then there is likelihood of losing your vows and getting your ordination disturbed. So similarly, in the case of women, if you are among if you are a nun, then likewise you should understand, if you are surrounded by a crowd of men, then again you have to be you have to guard your mind to ensure that your ordination is not disturbed. Verse 22, it is easy for me that my body becomes non-existent, my livelihood becomes non-existent, and my material wealth becomes non-existent, and my respect becomes non-existent. And it's also easy to accept the degeneration of my other virtuous deeds, but I should never allow my mind disturbed and degenerate. And in many cases, the degeneration of precepts take place because of attraction towards wealth, desire, and so on. So your body, your material facilities, these are not so important. And it's fine that if you lose all of them, and it's also fine that it is also fine even if you lose your other virtuous deeds. But you should never allow the degeneration of guarding your mind, protecting your mind, and therefore never allow the degeneration of the virtuous qualities of your mind. And those who want to guard their mind, with folded hands, I would like to request everybody that those of you who want to guard your mind, you must guard so with the presence of mindfulness and alertness and with effort. And mindfulness here refers to the fact of not forgetting the virtuous practices, and consciousness or alertness here refers to remaining careful whether you are undertaking any negative ways of life or not. Now, if those people who are disturbed by certain sicknesses, then these people are weak and powerless in doing any kind of job. And similarly, when our mind is disturbed by ignorance and confusion, then again we are without power and capacity to all kinds of virtuous practices. So in the case of a person who has been disturbed because of certain sickness, then one's mind becomes unclear and one physically becomes weak, and therefore one is unable to do all types of activities. Similarly, due to the degeneration of mindfulness, and one becomes confused and ignorant, and if one's mind gets disturbed, then again one will be without power to perform any positive action. And a person who is without alertness, even if one undertakes hearing, thinking and meditation, then it will be like pouring water in a pot that is leaking at the bottom, or a pot which has a crack. So nothing will stay within one's mind. Just as when you put or pour water in a cracked pot, the water will leak and will not stay in the pot. So similarly, in the absence of mindfulness and alertness, you will not be able to retain it. Even if you have some understanding based on hearing and thinking, and similarly some understanding of meditation, but still, because of absence of continuous practice of mindfulness and alertness, like that leaking pot, like the water in the leaking pot, all your virtuous practice will gradually disappear. And so even except in the case of those people who have very strong wisdom and who has a very stable experience, in the beginning, in the case of ordinary practitioners like us, unless we are able to continuously practice it with the use of mindfulness and alertness, our virtuous practices will degenerate and will disappear. So therefore it is important to maintain mindfulness and alertness. And verse 26 again explains the same point by saying that even those people who have much hearing and who also have a lot of devotion and who also are quite industrious and who makes a lot of effort, but because of the absence of introspection, because of alertness, because of not judging oneself, because of such a fault, one will experience the defilement of downfalls. And those people who are without introspection and alertness,
that
And without alertness and introspection, when the mind becomes completely free and relaxed and understand, then the afflictive emotions who are like robbers and dacoits, they will come and destroy your mindfulness. And therefore, even those merits that you have accumulated earlier, they will be robbed by such afflictive emotions, and you will fall into negative state of existence. And in the case of this this group of thieves and robbers of afflictive emotions, they are great opportunists. And as and when they find opportunity, they will rob your virtuous deeds, and they will take the life of happy state of existence and destroy it. So when you allow yourself being controlled by such afflictive emotions, and then they rob away all the positive fruits of your virtuous deeds. Now, for example, when afflictive emotions, like when anger arises, we do feel that anger comes as our friend. When you encounter an unpleasant experience and object, then suddenly anger arises, and therefore when anger arises, it appears as if it had come to help you. Yes, to some extent it is true, because when you get angry, you become more bold, and you are sometimes you become more decisive, and you are able to take the actions. And it is also possible that you are able to get some advantage and benefit temporarily. And for example, when someone says something nasty or negative, then if you get angry, then suddenly you will be able to give a strong response. So in this way, anger is helping you. And if you are not angry, then you might remain quiet. So anger comes as if it is helping us, but in reality we are being deceived, so anger is deceiving us. And similar is the case when attachment arises. Attachment arises and comes as if the attachment is our closest friend. And then in the pursuit of desire, in the pursuit of fulfillment of the desire, it makes its every effort. And because of improper mental engagement, influenced by attachment and desire, it exaggerates the object. And then attachment constantly tells us, you must go after this object. The object is so wonderful, so attractive. You must never lose the opportunity. So again, here you can see attachment comes as a very close friend, but ultimately we are ruined by such afflictive emotions. So therefore they are really thieves. These afflictive emotions, they are really like thieves and robbers. So they come in a very unmanifested way, quietly, and destroys us. And I have been sharing this with many people. And when anger comes, it provides you a new energy, new force. And if you are not angry, and then at that time, if particularly if it's a difficult job like climbing uphill, and which is difficult, and when you are not angry, it may be quite difficult to you. But if you are very angry, then you will get some extra energy, and you will be able to go up much easier. And when you get angry, you get some extra energy in your muscles and in your arms, and it gives that kind of intensity in the mind. And because of this increased intensity of the mind, the body also gets some kind of extra energy. But this is the stupid energy, and it is not sure whether this energy will help you and harm you. It's a blind energy. And in the real sense, If you are to confront an enemy, and if you do so with anger and hatred, then it is not sure whether you will be able to confront the enemy precisely or not, whether you will be able to hit the target or not. Mentally you may be thinking that I'm really challenging and facing my enemy, but because you are blind with anger, in the long run you will suffer, and temporarily also you might make a mess of the whole situation. Take the example of beating a dog. Now, for example, if you are extremely angry with that dog, and because you are intoxicated and your whole body is shaking with anger, and then with that kind of physical composure, if you chase the dog and try to beat the dog, then because you are mad and angry, instead of being able to hit the dog, you might hit at your shins or at your legs. But on the other hand, if you really want to challenge your enemy, then without getting angry and with full composure and judging the situation, and then if you take an action, you will be able to hit the target precisely. Now, for example, if you are chased by a mad dog, and if you maintain your calmness of the mind, then you will be able to think whether it is easier for you to run away or take a stone and hit at the dog. You will be able to take into account all these situations. So, of course, if you are in such a situation where you are chased by a mad dog, then you can't just sit there saying, I am a practitioner of compassion, which is stupid. And also, if you use a knife in something, then this will be killing. So, just to stop that attack from the mad dog, if you hurl a stone, that will help you. And that is why we very often see some people who, when they are angry, say all kinds of aggressive, negative, harsh words, but later on when they cool down, they get so embarrassed, and they were quietly shocked to remember what they've been saying. And next day when you meet that same person, you get really blushed, you get very embarrassed, and you will not be able to face that person. It is true that you got some extra energy because of anger, but that anger is out of confusion, that anger is out of stupidity, and therefore this kind of energy is not sure whether it will hit the target or not. And therefore, without being angry, and if you judge the situation and be very realistic and then take a stand, then it will be very effective. Now, for example, if you study the many ways of life of Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattvas have different activities, like the activities of peace, wrathful activities, activities of increase, control, and so on. And when they perform many of these wrathful activities, they do so motivated by compassion and not being overpowered by anger and hatred. And motivated by anger and hatred, there is no way you are allowed to perform such wrathful actions. So even in the tantric text, when it speaks about employing hatred on the path, it primarily refers to a kind of aggressive attitude, aggressive behavior, rather than hatching ill will or resentment in the mind. And therefore, without giving up compassion, without giving up altruism, and since there is no other course, no other method, so therefore by understanding the situation, the reality, and you know, therefore in order to be able to take a strong action, you express yourself in an aggressive manner, motivated by compassion. So in reality, your mind is still not disturbed. And I'm explaining this because many of us get the wrong impression that these afflictive emotions like attachment, hatred are useful, and that this gives color to the life. this makes the life attractive. We feel like that, and this is absolutely wrong. So as soon as an opportunity is found, these afflictive emotions temporarily make our mind dull and destroy the possibilities of developing any kind of virtuous attitudes, and then in the long run, in the future, it destroys all the positive consequences and fruits, and it is in this way they destroy the life of a happy state of existence. And therefore, in this way you will be able to see the need to maintain mindfulness, and therefore you should never allow mindfulness go away from the door of your mind. And even if mindfulness departs from your mind, you immediately should recall the harms of negative state of existence and maintain mindfulness and set your mind on the chosen object. And what are the factors for developing such mindfulness? This is explained in verse 30. By remaining in association and contact with the lamas, and by following the teachings taught by abbots, and by developing some sense of fear, and by showing respect to the precepts as a fortunate practitioner, then you are able to quickly develop mindfulness. The Tibetan word lama means the word lama refers to someone who is on a higher state, on a supreme state. Now why these people are termed as higher and superior? They are higher and superior in terms of their knowledge and qualification, in terms of their kindness. The Sanskrit equivalent for the Tibetan word lama is guru, so this is an exact and correct translation. Whereas in the Chinese language, when they use the word gofu, the word gofu has the meaning of a living Buddha, and this is a total misunderstanding of the meaning, because the word lama, either the Tibetan word lama or the Sanskrit or Indian word guru, has no connotation of a living Buddha. And so the word lama and guru is not saying that someone is a Buddha or someone is a bodhisattva. It simply speaks about someone who has high quality and high knowledge and who is very kind to you. So among the category of lamas, there could be a Buddha, there could be a bodhisattva, there could be an ordinary person. On the other hand, if you translate a lama as a living Buddha, then it will make much mistake. And then I have been also saying this repeatedly, because today in the society we talk so much about, we have so much, people rush so much after the so-called tulku or reincarnations. And that's why I made the statement that there are four possibilities in between the lama and the tulkus. One could be a lama and not a tulku, one could be a tulku but not a lama, one who is both and one who is neither. And finally, I would also say that basically speaking, there are too many reincarnations these days. And now gradually things are degenerating to such an extent that when a geshe passes away, then people think that there is a reincarnation, and their followers come up and get recognized something. And gradually a time will come that the father and mother of a house, they will also have their reincarnation. and then probably it may be the task and responsibility of their children to say that this is reincarnation of my father, this is reincarnation of my mother. And of course, if we are thinking in terms of a kind of rebirth of our past karmas, then of course we are all reincarnations. But when we talk about real reincarnation, we are not talking about the rebirth that is result of negative karma and actions. But we are talking about some people who, through their spiritual practice and realization, who come specifically, intentionally. The number of monks in the Tibetan monasteries are not so much, and among the small population of monks there are so many reincarnations, and there is a risk of everybody becoming a reincarnation. So if all the monks become reincarnations, where will you find the attendants when the child is? Then probably you have to recruit from the lay community. You have to invite your parents as the attendants or chanses. So therefore, all I'm saying is that it's extremely important that the Lama should be really qualified. And from the tantric point of view, Lama is someone who is able to, not only able to confer the initiations as is explained in the four classes of Tantra, but particularly who is able to confer the highest initiation and who is able to experience, who is able to confer the fourth level of the initiation, the word initiation, based on his own experience. So such a Lama is said to be the highest category of Lama, who is able to explain the meaning of union at the stage of training and the union at the stage of normal learning based on his own experience. So therefore, normally when we reflect on the meaning of spiritual teacher in relation to the Tantra, then we think about a Lama or spiritual teacher who is able to explain the meaning of the fourth initiation. And if the Lama is someone who is really able to explain the meaning of the union at the stage of training and the stage of normal learning, then that Lama must be a Buddha. So depending upon various levels of practices, whether you undertake sutric practice or tantric practice, there are different categories of Lama, and what is important is that the Lama should really fulfill those qualities. So it's really important that the Lama be qualified. And how do we determine that the Lama is qualified or not? And as we discussed earlier, while reading about Sakawa and we read that he took many months to find out the authenticity of the genuineness of the teaching. So it's really important on your part to experiment the teacher, whether they are qualified or not. And particularly in the case of our Western friends who are now interested in studying Buddhism and interested in finding a teacher. So therefore, in your case, it is extremely important not to rush, but to find a proper teacher. So it is not necessary that whoever from whomever you receive a teaching, you have to regard that person as your teacher or spiritual master. That is not necessary. You can, with a positive attitude, just receive the teaching and listen to the lecture, and with a long time association, and if you are able to see that as person something unique, something special in terms of his qualification, in terms of discipline and so on, then you can approach him and take him as your teacher. And this should be the same with the case of the Tibetans also. Unfortunately, in the past, it is said that the more Lama has followers and cavalries, then that Lama is said to be people tend to see it as a very high Lama. And then there are stories of some other great Lamas who are without such number of followers and so on. And if you read the case of story of Zapatu Rinpoche, when he kept on staying in one place and gave teaching, then he started getting more and more students, and he got a little bit tired of that, and he ran away from left that place, and he visited one house, and in that house he remained completely disguised as a very sincere practitioner, with poor quality clothes and so on. And then one of his followers, thinking that Pedro Rinpoche should be somewhere there, she was looking around, and then finally this student of Zapatu Rinpoche visited the mother of that house where Zapatu Rinpoche was living, and asked him, have you seen this great Lama Zapatu Rinpoche? Then this mother said, no, I never seen such a great Lama, but I saw a kind of religious kind of beggar, and he just went out. And then this student asked him, how did he look like, kind of cloth and his feature and so on. And actually at that time the mother of the house had sent Zapatu Rinpoche to throw her pot of urine out. So when he learned from this student that he was such a great Lama, then she got so ashamed and embarrassed that she ran away leaving the house. And then there is a story of another Lama who was traveling with Dongtumba, who looked like a nomadic fellow, and so he was traveling with one Ngakwa, and because Dongtumba looked poor and an ordinary person, and then this Ngakwa asked him to carry his shoes, and when he was about to reach the monastery, then there was a large number of monks waiting there, ready to receive them. This Ngakwa, who met Dongtumba carry his shoes, he got surprised, and since nobody knows me, they should not be really making a line waiting for me, so what is this all about? And he asked somebody, and in fact he asked the Dongtumba to whom they are welcoming. Then Dongtumba very humbly said, since they know me, probably they are waiting for me. So these great masters, they were really practicing the teaching which says the practice of humility is the stepping stone for really becoming great. And there is really no need to make a show of it. But unfortunately, in our case, we are completely empty inside, and we are so fond of showing outside, and without showing much interest in our study, we show interest in material gifts and wealth, and particularly in the case of those lamas who confer initiations, including me. And in our case, we have all these initiation substances like drums and bells and many other paraphernalia, and also when we receive the initiation, we put on all the costumes, and inside again we are empty and have no idea. So here, of course, I see some monks from the upper and lower tantric college, and I'm not making a sarcastic remark to you, but I'm simply saying we all have to be very careful. So in your case also, I know you are very good in doing so many types of prayers, and you make a lot of effort in your chantings, but if you have no idea what you are chanting, it's a kind of self-exhaustion. So as I was saying, and in fact I did not discuss it formally with some Dharma centers and so on, but I think it is really important.
don't say that thing here. And what power of it is, and 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 it
Then another thing that I want to do is when people request me to about some reincarnation or something, and for example, when some students they request me about the possibilities of reincarnation and so on of their teacher and so on, then sometimes I do a divination, and when the divination comes out, that's good. Then simply I tell them the divination, outcome of the divination is good. But then you should not use my divination as an excuse to say that His Holiness has recognized this. So He should be given a special throne, and we have different types of robes. And what is important is that, yes, there is this positive indication, but what is important is to undertake such a spiritual practice which will fulfill these positive indications. So right from the beginning, if you remain as an ordinary monk and undertake your studies properly, then that will be wonderful. Now, on the other hand, right from the beginning, if you call someone as a reincarnation, and not only you are recognized as a reincarnation of an abbot or about a throne holder and so on, then not only such a person is recognized, but then you employ 3-4 people as attendants and treasurer and so on. And then later on, if that so-called recognized lama makes a disgrace of his life, then that is really sad. You know, you've destroyed the study opportunity of some other people, and you lead a disgrace and discourage many other people. So I certainly felt. So I don't know really how should I meddle into this matter, you know. I felt like saying this, and I'm just mentioning this. So in my case, it seems sometimes I'm related to this, I must have sent something, and sometimes I feel that I'm not directly related to it. And if you're really a recognized Lama, then you should be a source of inspiration to those people who follow you and who look towards you as an example, that you should be calm, quiet, peaceful, and this kind of life and example will leave a positive imprint in the minds of other people. And with that kind of disciplined way of life, if you give some positive instructions and teachings to other people, then it will be very beneficial and useful. So here in the verse it says, so you need a good lama, and similarly good friends. You should take the examples of good friends who undertakes good spiritual studies and who have less worldly activities to do, and who is really a learned scholar and disciplined and of good nature and good conduct. So in the past, we used to have few people who are recognized as possessing these three qualities of learnedness, discipline, and good heart. And I have been telling people that since we have opportunity for study for everybody, so today, with this changed time, it is important that all of us should become learned, disciplined, and good-hearted. And we get opportunity to study in all the ordinary schools, and also we get opportunity to study in the monastic institutions. And it will not be enough to follow the old system of study in the religious monastic institutions. And particularly if you reflect carefully, unless you take good care of the young students who join the monasteries, unless you give a good education to them, it will be very sad that, for example, later on when these young monks, when they grow, and then on the one hand, they did not get proper education, and when they were young, they did not get opportunity to go to the usual school. And also when they were in monastery, they were not able to understand the meaning. They were only asked to recite some mantras and prayers. So later on, these people, when they grow up, they will become very regretful of their life. So it is really, if this happens, then it's really very sad. So therefore, it's really important that to give good explanation of the teaching to these young monks. And if you give proper teaching to these young monks, and then later on, even if they are unable to remain as a monk and get disrobed and become a father or mother, even in that situation, because they know the Dharma, it will be very helpful and productive in the society. And if you do not give education in that sense, then there is a likelihood of wasting the life of many children. And so we really have to be very, very careful in terms of giving proper education. And we have the facility that all the Tibetans become with these three qualities, become a person with these three qualities, that on the one hand they have knowledge and learnedness, and then at the same time they are disciplined and also have a kind heart. And particularly in the case of understanding of Dharma, if you are someone who has some far-sightedness, who has some open-mindedness, then they will definitely see the benefit of Dharma practice. So unless you are able to understand Dharma with the mind, directly it is of not much help. For example, it is in terms of getting food, clothing and drinks, simply by praying, all these things will not come. And in fact, this is what has been told by Chinese to the Tibetan Tibetans who are in the prison, and they would torture them by saying that since you have so much faith in the Buddhas and so on, so now you pray and you will get your food, you will get your drinks and so on. So on the other hand, if you are able to know that many of these mental illnesses and wrong attitudes can be removed by understanding the Dharma, then you will be able to develop some sense of appreciation to the teaching of the Dharma. And if your mind is narrow and not far-sighted, then probably you will not think about these long-term benefits through the study of Dharma, but rather you will get absorbed with your daily catering to your daily needs. I'll tell you another story. There was one abbot in a come, and someone came to see him. So this person came into the room of the abbot, and then he asked him, where is the abbot? And then the attendant of the abbot, he said, the abbot has gone out to frighten the old men and the women. So meaning that when you explain the Dharma, and if you talk about the presence of the hot hell and the cold hell and all these frightening things, so all this has to be understood. If you are unable to explain the possibilities of all this through the interconnected reality and the cause-effect relationship, then it is really like frightening other people, explaining about hot hells and cold hell. So people, for some people, they get this kind of idea and this kind of impression. So it's really important if one is able to gain a good insight about the whole process of teaching of the Buddha, no intelligent person can deny the truth of such teachings. And I think, as I said earlier, and some of the scientists who normally do not have any faith to any religious practice, but when they hear the explanation from the Buddhist point of view, they show special attention, they pay special attention and show special interest. And therefore it is really important to get education and knowledge. So when we talk about getting the education and knowledge, it is not like feeding the computer. It's not like putting something in the computer and then later discovering it. What is important is that you should teach people the technique to exercise their mind. And your knowledge should not be like what is being put in the computer or what is being recorded on a tape recorder cassette. But what is important is what is being taught, whether it is a school text or it's a religious text. The teacher should be able to guide the student, and then later on the student should individually be able to explore and focus on it and find the real contradictions and the meaning of all those teachings. So sometimes I do feel our whole process of study becomes almost like passing one stone from one hand to another person. So people keep on saying the same thing all the time. And I did see some geshes who have fairly good idea of the text, that they read. But as soon as they read a new text, suddenly they get lost. So this clearly shows that something is wrong, something is lacking. And so these people, they are able to pick up what is being taught in the classroom, and they were not able to use the same process of analysis and investigation when they move on to some other subjects. So therefore, in the case of students, religious students, it is really not enough to continue with the same process and same techniques of debating, raising the same problematic questions, not getting a proper answer all the time. So what is being taught should be treated as a key to open the door of your wisdom, so that later on you are able to judge things by yourself. And it is in this way we will really be able to uphold the teaching and culture. And in this regard, I do feel in the case of Westerners, generally speaking, of course there are many silly, stupid Westerners, but generally speaking, in terms of investigation analysis, they are very good. Now, for example, when I explain Dharma, particularly to the Tibetans or the Chinese, they show so much interest towards blessing and initiation. But when I explain the text, there's not many people who take notes and record the teachings. Whereas in the case of most of the Westerners, either they would be writing something or they would be recording something, and they have this interest to understand the crux of the teaching. So that's why I think to some extent in the Western world so much material development has taken place, because they have analyzed things and took steps to make more progress. And that's why you see that they take interest not only in the religious traditions of their forefathers, but they take so much interest in the Eastern ways of life, Eastern culture, Eastern thought, Buddhist teaching, and so on. And they are taking such interest in such Buddhist teachings, not for money, not for fame. So that's the general attitude. And I'm saying general attitude. There are exceptions, because there are some people who undertake Buddhist practice so that they also get recognized as a good Lama. And I've also seen some Westerners who are very fond of wearing very funny costumes, making a display of themselves. So therefore, if you reflect carefully and analyze things for yourself, and see things from wider perspective and analyze things from wider perspective, then you will really be able to appreciate our Tibetan culture and Tibetan religion. And it is in this way we can preserve our culture and preserve our religion. We need to preserve and our culture and religion because it is still relevant, it is really still very useful. On the other hand, if it is just outdated and not useful, then there is no need to preserve it. Now, for example, there are certain Tibetan cultural clippings. For example, if you see some senior lama or some, then you keep on scratching your head or your your ears and saying la la. So these things are kind of cultural clippings and not necessary at all. So some of these unnecessary cultural clippings, even if you say these are very wonderful, very important, and make the best of effort and try to preserve it, you will not be able to preserve them more than 100 years. Whereas there are, on the other hand, there are many good cultural aspects, as has been discussed in this text, Bodhicharyavatara, to be kind-hearted, to be compassionate, to develop love, to develop altruism. These are the qualities that we will always be in need of, so long as we have this urge for happiness and urge not to experience suffering. So did you understand the point that I am making? So this is my feeling. So it is, as it said, it's in the text, it says that you should associate with a lama, or in other words, someone who has intelligence, someone who is able to show you the right path. So by associating with this kind of people, then and similarly listening to the teaching and following the teaching, and then reflecting on the nature of suffering of change, and particularly conditioned of suffering, and then showing respect and veneration to the precepts, meaning that when you are able to see the need and importance of such precepts, then you are able to quickly develop mindfulness. Verse 31, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, they possess wisdom eye, which is unhindered, which is unobstructed. And this is again very true, because in our case, we have this habit of leading a duplicity of life, that we try to be very nice and very good in the face of other people, but when we are alone and nobody sees, nobody understands, we do all kind of negative things, destructive things. So what is being said here in this text is, yes, you can deceive ordinary enlightened human beings, but you can't deceive Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who possess the omniscient wisdom and mind which is unobstructed. But unfortunately, sometimes we do think that we undertake certain negative deeds, and even though we feel that Buddha may be watching or Bodhisattvas may be watching, but still again we think they may be watching, but they are so compassionate, so they will not so they will not bother me. And so what is important is, whenever you are about to do certain negative deed, you should realize that you are being watched by the omniscient Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, that they are always there. And if you think in this way, then you will be able to develop some sense of embarrassment and shame, and develop respect and sense of awe and fear. And such a thing will arise by recollecting the Buddha repeatedly. And therefore it is important to repeatedly remember the Buddha. And I think this is again very important, because in fact someone told me that if you are a Gelugpa, you know no other higher beings except Tsongkhapa or Tsongkhapa. If you are Nyingmapa, then probably you know only Guru Rinpoche and no one else. So you may not be knowing even the Buddha. And particularly if we visit different monasteries, you will find that first of all, you will say that, okay, I belong to Nyingma or Gelug school. And then you say, okay, I belong to this college. Then in this monastery, and then you say, I belong to this college of the monastery. Then belong to this dormitory or house of the college. And then finally, it is me, the most important one, the I. To some extent, there is some justification That's why today you find so many countries saying that our country is the center of the world. And this is some element of truth, because when you talk about, when you count the directions, normally you do so from the place where you are. So in that way you are the center. So if you repeatedly think about the Buddha and remember his qualities, then you develop some kind of feeling of closeness and then develop respect. Verse 33 says that if you have that mindfulness, and then you will also be able to develop the introspection. And even if you lose such an introspection, it will come back again. Verse 34. So therefore, whatever activity that you do, whether you are going, sleeping, whatever, you should examine and analyze it and find about the nature of your mind, whether this is faulty or with qualities. And if you know that your mind is at fault and making mistakes, and particularly if you are developing certain negative motivations, then you should try to remain like a piece of wood, unmovable, unmoving, and without letting yourself being controlled by the afflictive emotions. So in this verse 34, it is saying that when you encounter an object in relation to which you adopt certain habits or discard certain habits, then at that time you should maintain mindfulness and develop introspection. And if you find that your motivation is influenced by afflictive emotion, then you should stay like a piece of wood. And when you go around, do not get totally lost and distracted looking towards all directions as if you have lost something. However, and if it is necessary for certain virtuous practices, and so therefore when normally you should not look towards all directions, get distracted, but rather cast your eye down and look towards the place in front of you, toward where you are walking. And if you get tired of moving in that way, then in order to take rest, sometimes you should look towards some other directions. And suddenly if someone comes within the focus of your eye, then you should look at it and say, welcome, how are you, and so on. Do not pretend as you are a great practitioner, not seeing everybody. And also in order to find out the fears of the road, you should repeatedly look towards the directions. So His Holiness is saying, yes, of course, to some extent, this is something that we all know, but you can appreciate the fact that Buddha and his followers, they are so precise in giving a detailed explanation of such ways of life. So it's really what he's saying is that while walking, if you look towards all directions, then that is not easy for you. So if you really want to look towards some directions, probably halt and look around and then go. And when you take rest, then you can look back and or in front. So in all situations, you should practice by knowing the purpose and the reason. And similar is the case with the posture of your seat. For example, if you are doing a meditation, then you should know that your posture should be just 7 or 8 Vairochana posture and sit in a proper manner. And then occasionally you should examine whether you're observing the same posture or not. Mind is like a mad elephant, and therefore it should be tied to the great pillar of Dharma. And therefore make sure that after tying the mind to the object, you should make a lot of effort. Now it is much easier to examine when the body and the speech gets distracted to control them. But when the mind gets distracted, it's extremely difficult to control it. So therefore, here in this verse number 40, it says that the mind is like an elephant, and because of habituated with affluent emotions, it gets distracted and excited on and off, and therefore, with the help of mindfulness, let the mind remain on the chosen object with every effort. So whatever happens in your pursuit of meditative stabilization, do not get distracted even for a moment, whether you are walking or sleeping or sitting. And particularly in the case when you are trying to actualize one-pointed meditation, then you are not allowed even to let your mind focus on some other virtuous practices, not even for one moment. And what you really remember is what is that object where your mind is focusing. And then there are some other occasions, for example, as is explained in verse 42, there are other occasions if there is a likelihood of encountering some fear, and if you are in a situation where you are participating or enjoying a celebration or a festival, then on those occasions, it is not possible to maintain mindfulness as you were doing during the meditative session. So therefore, you should lead a way of life that is comfortable and for you. Now, such ways of practices are possible because Buddha himself has very clearly said that if you are engaging the practice of giving, then at that time you can forget, or there's no need to think about observance of morality. And of course, generally speaking, the preceding practice of the six perfections are kind of lower forms of practices, and the later parts of the six perfections are more lofty and more important. However, if you're focusing on one of these practices, there are occasions when you can remain neutral with some other practices. Now, for example, if a bhikshu is passing through a forest, and if a hunter asks this bhikshu, "Did you see a deer running away?" And then this bhikshu, even if he has seen the deer, and if the bhikshu has seen the deer, and if he says that the deer went in this direction, then that is of course absolutely true, and he has seen the direction where the deer is going. But in order to undertake the practice of giving of fearlessness, in order to protect the life of that deer, if you compare the heaviness of these two actions, telling the lie or protecting the life of the deer, then protecting the life of the deer is more important. So therefore, even though the bhikshu has seen the direction of the direction where the deer has gone, So he can make a very clever answer by saying, "Oh, I'm not so really clear. I think I saw somebody moving here, but I'm really not aware which direction it has gone." So you can make such a statement. So in order to give fearlessness to others, it is encouraged to tell such kind of light lies. Verse 43 says that having made a preparation and having made a plan to prepare something or to practice something, then you should only think of that and not of others. Because if you do so, if you pay attention to that action, then so with that intention, you should complete that work, that work and that action. And if you do that, then you will be able to fulfill every work successfully. And if you start something and then leave it unfinished and then start another, then you will not be able to complete the first project or first work, and will also be not able to fulfill the second. So with this kind of attitude, the secondary afflictive emotions, which are confused to what is to be given up and what is to be practiced, all this non-conscientious or non-introspection will not multiply. Now, verse 45 reads that if you are engaging in meaningless or senseless conversation, all types of senseless conversations, and so engaging in many senseless conversations, as is the habit of some people, and one starts telling one thing to another, and then the second person will start saying that to another slightly in a different form, and the third will start saying it to the fourth one, again presenting it in a slightly different form. And this makes a lot of disturbance and unhappiness in the mind of many people. So this is how you divide among the people. So therefore, do not be fond of engaging in many senseless conversation, or do not be fond of watching so many different types of shows or performances. And if you, when you have this habit of entering into this, then remember that these are attachments and try to get them out. Do not dig the ground or cut the grass without any reason, and do not make drawings on the ground everywhere without any reason. And if you are doing this, then immediately you should remember the instruction of the Buddha and with fear give up such meaningless activities. And if you wish to, if with attachment, if you are planning to go somewhere, and with attachment and so on, you are about to say something, and at that time you should watch your mind and maintain stability of the mind and do not enter into it. Verse 48, if your mind is developing attachment or about to become angry, at that time do not do any action, do not say anything, remain like a piece of wood. If you are developing an attitude where you make fun of others or laugh unnecessarily or make a sarcastic remark on others out of arrogance, pride, and also if you develop wish to dig out the faults of others, and also if you are about to say something which will create dissension among other people, and if you have a mind to deceive others, in other words, do not say anything which is improper, unsuitable to others, or which is deceiving. So if there is likelihood of expressing yourself in this way, then you should remain like a piece of wood and maintain mindfulness. And it is the task of introspection to first of all watch it and then maintain mindfulness that this is improper, and then you should remain like a piece of wood. without saying or without doing anything. And if someone praises you and or about to blame someone else, and if you're able to say some harsh word, and then at that time also remain like a piece of food. And similarly, if you obtain some wealth, and if you desire name and fame, and if you desire to have retinues and attendants and so on, and if your mind is craving for respect, and at that time remain like a piece of wood, and mentally if you are neglecting the well-being of others and purposes of other beings, and aspiring to fulfill your purposes, and you wish to speak about it, then remain like a piece of wood. Verse 53, if you develop impatience or laziness and develop fear and shamelessness and talk nonsense, and if you develop also a wish to get biased towards your side, and at that time remain like a piece of wood. And in this way you should thoroughly examine the mind which is influenced by afflictive emotions, and the efforts that you are making meaninglessly, and do not allow yourself being controlled by such meaningless effort and the influence of afflictive emotions. And under such an occasion, you should maintain mindfulness and side with the antidotes and remain stable without change of the mind. And when you actually benefit, try to benefit others, and particularly in order to be able to bring about greater benefit, you should be full of capacity and full of powerful. So therefore, first of all, you should be very certain about the subject that you are studying or that you are about to do. For example, if you are lost and you do not know what you should be doing, then it will not be effective. So therefore, whatever you are going to do, you should have a thorough knowledge of it, first of all. And then secondly, you should have total conviction towards that action. And again, I felt like telling a story. I suddenly remembered one of my bodyguard, a monk. So whenever I asked him to do something, he would immediately say "lo los," which means "yes, I will," but he didn't really pay much attention. And then suddenly he consulted one of his other bodyguards and said what His Holiness said. So it should not be like that. You should have a thorough knowledge of the work that you are going to do, and then secondly, you should have total conviction of what you are doing, and then you should have total determination, meaning that your mind should be stable. And while you actually do the work, you should do it with sense of veneration and respect or appreciation of your work and respect to others. And similarly, you have the feeling of shameness and fear towards the negative results if you don't do it properly. And while you're actually doing the job, your sense faculties or your sense powers should be completely disciplined, so that your activities are appreciated and liked by others. So therefore you should make an effort that would please and that would make others happy. And then in the verse 56 it says that in the case of those who undertake bodhisattva practice, there is likelihood of being controlled by others, which would then become an obstruction. And this verse 56 says that you should not be so what is being said is that you should be you should act like a person who is farsighted and who is open and should not be suddenly get discouraged. Now in the case of those who are narrow-minded and whose minds are not open, whose attitudes are not open, they get suddenly discouraged. So here you are encouraged by saying that if there's a disagreement with the people that you walk, and because of certain activities because when you walk with other people, there will be many you should not be discouraged by the childish desires and works of other people. So whenever you encounter such problems, then do not get angry towards those childlike unenlightened beings. Simply realize that they are controlled by short-sightedness and afflictive emotions, so therefore you should not get discouraged. And therefore in the next two lines it says that you should possess compassion, thinking that such attitudes among these childlike peoples are there because of development of afflictive emotions. And when you enter into such virtuous practices that is not unwholesome, then you should do so, so that this is of benefit to yourself and to other sentient beings. And here it is important that your mind be influenced by the understanding that the eye is like an emanation and doesn't have inherent or true existence. So in this way, without pride and arrogance, you should always maintain your mind. And then you should repeatedly think about the fact that after a long time, I have found this precious human life with leisure, and therefore this mind I will hold without any change, like Mount Meru, as we discussed earlier, that is as an indication that we have performed afflictive emotions for so many lives. And therefore, it is almost impossible to have obtained such a human life. And therefore, here the text says that I have obtained this supreme leisure, supreme life of a human being after a long time. And therefore, I will make this human life meaningful. And therefore, your mind should be like a mountain that has been planted firm and stable. Now, when you engage in virtuous practices, you encounter difficulties because of unserviceability of your body. So this is explained in verse 59, how to deal with that. So from verse 59, Chandideva explains about the practice of morality of collecting virtuous qualities. Now in our case, there is no use to develop excessive attachment towards our human body, because after you die, then the vulture who is obsessed or who has great craving towards the flesh, that vulture after your death will play with your body and drag and toss it about, and at that time you will have no unhappiness of the mind. So therefore, why you are so concerned about it today? and therefore do not lead a way of life as all you do is to protect your body. And therefore, you the mind, why you become possessed with this body and why you try to guard it? Because this, you and the body, these two are separate, they are different. So what use of this body? Meaning that at the time of the death, you will give the body and the body will also give you up. And what is the use of body at that time? And therefore, why you the mind out of confusion?
Out of confusion.
Develop so much attachment, and instead of developing so much attachment to your impure body, why don't you cherish a pure body of Buddha that is made out of wood? And in the case of this body, it is like a machine that produces what is impure. So what is the use of guarding this putrid body? And if you try to reflect within this body, you will find nothing that is of importance. And so first of all, you look at your skin, the layers of your skin, and try to understand the layers of this skin with your wisdom and intelligence. And then you should also separate your flesh, and then you will see a network of bones. And so in this way you should use the weapon of wisdom and separate all of this individually, and particularly, and then you should remove and think about the bones, and keep on looking until to the marrow, and you will find nothing that is of essence. They are all impure and they are dirty. And in this way you should analyze and examine yourself. So when you behold and look in this way, and when you search in this way, you won't find anything that is precious. Even after searching and making effort in this way, still if you are still you will not be able to see any essence. And this being the case, why still you are so attached to this body, and why you guard this? And additionally, you can't eat this impure body, and you can't drink the blood, and you can't suck the intestines, and therefore what is use of this body? And why you got this body, which will finally become a food of the vultures, and and the wolves, and the body of all human beings are fit only to be employed, only to be used. And otherwise, even if you guard this body so much, when the Lord of Death, who is without compassion, comes, then the Lord of Death will just rob off your body and give it to the dogs and the birds. And at that time, what will you do? And even in an ordinary sense, and when at the time when the slaves are of no use, then they will stop giving facilities like clothes and so on. So therefore, even if you take a lot of care and pamper this body, it will soon depart from yourself. And therefore, why you tire yourself in guarding and protecting this body? So therefore, you must now give wages to this body and let it work for yourself. And without any use, why should you give everything to this body?
Mm-hmm. 看得到的明明这个名字了
So without any benefits, not to give everything means that there's no need to give food, clothing and so on without using your mind. And therefore, just regard this body like a ship as a basis to cross the ocean and to ocean of samsara and to fulfill the purpose of sentient beings and therefore try to transform this body into the body of a precious jewel and in this way do not allow yourself controlled by the negative deeds of body, speech and also mind and therefore you should gain some kind of freedom And if you are able to make your body useful, and then you become free and independent. So in this way, develop that sense of freedom and independence, and then with smile on the face, and by giving up scowling and frowning face to others. And should become a friend of everybody and be very honest in helping them. That means whenever you meet others, you should invite them and welcome them with a smile on the face and do not make an angry look or do not frown at others. Give up all these ugly expressions and become a friend to everybody. And this is indeed a wonderful teaching. And from your own side, with wholehearted sincerity, if you maintain this kind of closeness and friendship to others, you will be the one who will benefit. And I have been telling other people that smiling, being able to smile to others is a unique beauty with the human being. And since we all want a smile from others, first of all, you should produce that opportunity. And in order to get smile from others, from the depth of your heart, you should develop close feeling towards others. Now, on the other hand, if you frown and cast an angry look to others, and at the same time, if you expect smiles from others, then that is very unrealistic. And so you should be the first to smile and welcome others. And having done this, then later on, if people still remain suspicious and cast an angry look towards you, then you have every right to maintain a similar posture, and that's what I sometimes do. So here it's saying that you should become a friend to others and be honest. That means if you know something, say, yes, I know it, I help you. If you don't know something, say, I don't know it. Be very clear and very honest. And then what somebody to says that when you sit on a throne and then sit in a very peaceful manner, don't sit on the throne as if you are throwing the whole weight of your body on it with making a big noise and sound. And these are really good things. For example, now when we attend such a teaching, all of you may be sitting on one or the other pieces of cushions. Then when you take the cushions, do not do it as if you are throwing dust in the nose of everybody, but be careful to make sure that you are disturbing others or not. And also when you open the door, do not open it loudly, and because in some of the other neighboring rooms, some meditators or some other person may be sleeping, and if you close your door with a bang and noise, then people might suddenly wake up thinking that there is an earthquake or tremor. So just like the just like the herons or cranes or cats or like the thieves, you watch them, they go quietly, covertly and fulfill their purposes. Of course these are not very good examples, but you should understand the meaning. So quietly and covertly, without disturbing others, you should fulfill your purposes. And this is how Buddha led his life. And you should also be skillful in admonishing and directing others. And if someone gives you an unsolicited advice or unasked advice, then you should accept that with respect and appreciation, and you should become a student of everybody. And normally our tendency is if someone says something, then instead of listening to it, you might suddenly say, yeah, I know that very well. And when anything good is when said by others, then you should say this is excellent. And when you see someone collecting merit, then you should praise it and develop rejoice. And if when you praise others, if it is going to become a kind of flattery, then you should speak about their qualities, not rightly in the face of that person, but at his back or her back. And if someone speaks good qualities of someone else, then you should say, yeah, this is true, and repeat the same, and do the same. But normally our tendency is that if you hear someone praising the qualities of someone, then you might respond to this by saying, yeah, this is true, but you have not seen the other side of the person. And if someone says that Geshe-la has really, that Geshe-la is really a good scholar, then you might say, yeah, he's a good scholar, but his behavior. So therefore, if someone speaks about the qualities of others, you should simply join them and say this is true. And if someone speaks about your qualities or praises you, then don't become arrogant and proud, and don't get puffed up, but simply admire within the depth of your mind, thinking that it's good, yes, he's appreciating my qualities, so it's wrong to become arrogant. And so these are very interesting ways of looking at things. And if someone praises your quality, do not get arrogant and proud, but at the same time appreciate that he is appreciating the good qualities, in which you are also saying that yes, this person is someone who is able to appreciate the good things. So you are again admiring that person rather than yourself. And in this way, if you physically, verbally and mentally make an effort, then this will really will make peaceful and happiness. And it is this way that you can develop mental joy and happiness, the late Kinori Lama in the Jhansi Rinpoche used to say, that if you visit shop after shop saying that please sell me something that will make my mind peaceful and happy, nobody will be able to sell that. So therefore, it is very difficult and very rare to buy something by paying money or paying something. And therefore, when you hear about the qualities of others, you should feel happy and enjoy it. And so it is in this way, make others happy and make yourself happy. And if you adopt such an attitude, then there will be no reason why you will suffer in this life. And in the future lives also, there will be great happiness. Now, on the other hand, or contrarily, if you develop certain negative ways of life and develop certain shortcomings and faults, then that will make you temporarily unhappy and physically a lot of suffering. And in the life hereafter also, there will be great suffering. We have a short break here.